This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. If you watched this year's royal wedding, it may have been your first time hearing Bishop Michael Curry, the leader of the Episcopal Church. He preached at Meghan Markle's marriage to Prince Harry.
Love is not selfish and self-centered. Love can be sacrificial. And in so doing, becomes redemptive. And that way of unselfish, sacrificial, redemptive love changes lives.
That same weekend, a group of Christian leaders launched something called Reclaiming Jesus. It was a three-page creed that warned of, quote, a dangerous crisis of moral and political leadership at the highest levels of our government and in our churches, unquote. Bishop Curry was one of its authors.
We reject the resurgence of white nationalism and racism on many fronts,
including the highest levels of political leadership.
That was the bishop, followed by the Reverend Dr. Cynthia Hale of the Ray of Hope Christian Church. Nearly two dozen Christian leaders from various denominations signed Reclaiming Jesus. How do religious leaders lead flocks that are more partisan and less inclined to love across the aisle? And when it comes to earthly matters, can faith and love bring us together? We'll discuss it with Bishop Curry right after this.
There is a bond, and Gilead to save a sin-sick soul.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Gelmar CLR. Whatever you call your home, Gelmar knows you take great pride in keeping it clean. That's where CLR comes in. CLR dissolves calcium, lime, and rust all around the house using natural ingredients, not harsh chemicals. It even carries the EPA's Safer Choice seal. Keep your little piece of the planet looking its best with CLR, making the world a little cleaner.
When the world seems out of hand, you can count on the StoryCorps podcast for your dose of humanity. Unscripted conversations between real people about the things that matter most. This season, 12 all-new episodes about reunions and what it means to connect at this moment in our nation's history. Episodes are available every Tuesday.
Joining us from NPR in New York is Michael Curry, the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. His new book is called The Power of Love, Sermons, Reflections, and Wisdom to Uplift and Inspire. Bishop Curry, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
Let's start with the royal wedding. I gotta say, I wasn't expecting to watch the royal wedding at all. I didn't expect to get sucked into the royal wedding at all. I watched the whole thing. I totally got sucked in. And I think your sermon is a big reason why I kind of couldn't stop watching. It was just part of a beautiful ceremony. It was amazing all the way around. How do you reflect on being part of that?
You know, it was really a wonderful opportunity in a variety of ways. It was just an opportunity to be involved in something that actually brought people together, people who might not have come together otherwise. It was a beautiful blending of a bringing together of the worlds of the couple. I mean, not just Americans and Brits, but more than that, peoples around the world tuned in. 2 billion people watched that, which I find stunning. And you know, the truth is you're talking about people from most of the countries of the world, and you're talking about people who have different views probably about everything, different religious traditions, different political ideologies, different perspectives on a whole host of issues. And while we tuned in to see the bride's dress and, you know, to see the royal family and to see all the famous people who were there and to see who was wearing what and that kind of stuff, and that was part of it. But, you know, when you think about it, a wedding is basically two people who actually love each other. 2 billion people turned in to watch two people who love each other tell the world we love each other. That's a miracle. And that love of theirs brought together worlds of people, even for just a few moments, it was as though we focused in on love and not on what divides us and what hurts us. And that constitutes, for me, a miracle.
You write at the beginning of The Power of Love that you're not sure exactly why you were asked to deliver this sermon at the royal wedding, but I would love to get into how you crafted it and kind of how you write a sermon. What did you think of when you were writing this, and was it different from the way you would write a sermon under more typical circumstances?
Yes and no. I mean, it was different in the sense that I was fully aware that there was a larger congregation present, both physically and online and around the world. So I was aware of that. I was also aware of the congregation who was hearing that really was going to be a profoundly diverse one. I mean, we're talking about the diversity of the entire human family. So that's a little bigger than I normally would be preaching to. But I've learned over the years, I have to tell you, over the years, I've just kind of learned to focus in on the couple. And usually, if you're talking to them genuinely, you're going to be talking to their family, their friends, and everybody else who's there. And that was the case with this. But I didn't know, to be honest, I didn't know. I waited until I knew what the text from the Bible was. And when they selected the text, I was really delighted, because Song of Songs or Song of Solomon is not a book that most people are familiar with. And it's right there in the Bible. It's been there all along. It's a book of love poems. I mean, it really is a book of love poems that celebrates the beauty of the two who are in love with each other. And I mean, it's very physical, very material, deeply spiritual, emotional, romantic. I mean, it's love poems. And the book goes on with each one of the couple. They tell each other how much they love each other and why they love each other. And they go back and forth, back and forth. And there's sort of a Jerusalem chorus. It's like a Greek chorus, you know. And they're, I mean, I kind of think of it as Diana Ross and the Supremes. You kind of have the Supremes in the background kind of doing the doo-wop.
Right.
And that's going on while this couple tells each other how much they love each other and why they love each other. You're so beautiful. You're so wonderful. You're so smart. And then in the eighth chapter, where the text comes from, it's like the bride, the woman stops. It's like she stops and she says, this love is incredible. And it's as though she says, wait a minute, where does this love come from? And it's at that moment that she begins to look beyond the two of them and begins to point in the direction of a source of this love that's greater than the two of them, which starts to point in the direction of God.
I want to clarify, by the way, for those of you who are listening, that the passage that the bishop is referring to comes from the eighth chapter of Song of Solomon. It's two verses. Here are the verses that he's referring to. It's Song of Solomon, chapter 8, verses 6 and 7. And it reads, place me like a seal over your heart. I'm reading from the New International, by the way. Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death, its jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot sweep it away. If one were to give all the wealth of one's house for love, it would be utterly scorned.
Mm.
That's the sixth and seventh chapter, seventh verses of the eighth chapter of Song of Solomon. Glad to get some of your reflections on the church and on its role in creating a more loving world. Marcia Ellison tweets, I love presiding Bishop Michael Curry. I am a proud Episcopalian and grateful for his leadership. We met in Charlotte a few years ago. What a powerful preacher. Larry tweeted, I will forever be grateful to the Episcopal Church for being a refugee for me when I bitterly left the Southern Baptist Church. Though I ultimately left Christianity, the simple liturgy, gentle homilies, and comforting music gave me a soft place to nurse my existential wounds. I wonder if you could respond to that last one, Bishop Curry, particularly kind of the woundedness that people feel in our culture, one toward one another. It doesn't feel like a very loving time, but also the woundedness that some people feel within their faith. It seems like a lot of us are walking around with a lot of open wounds right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the reality is, I mean, the church and all of our churches are composed of human beings. And I'm one of them. You're one of them. We're, you know, human beings. And human beings are both saints and sinners all at the same time. We're both. But very often over the years, the church and the churches, not picking on any particular one, have, my theory is, whenever we stray away from the core teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, we stray into domains of our own selfishness. And when that begins to happen, then all sorts of things that are inconsistent with what we believe as Christians begin to become possible. And that's where people have been wounded. People have been hurt. That's where you have inquisitions. I mean, in history, we had, you know, think of the Spanish Inquisition. I'll never forget when I was in college and read the Brothers Karamazov and Dostoevsky's book. And I remember reading the Grand Inquisitor. The setting is Seville during the Spanish Inquisition when the Christian Church used means of persecution to force people to become Christians. And the Grand Inquisitor, in the story, Jesus comes back and appears in Seville. And the Grand Inquisitor questions him and interrogates him and eventually tries to banish Jesus of Nazareth. Whenever the church, I think part of what Dostoevsky was getting at, whenever the church has actually banished Jesus of Nazareth, put him in the corner, or tried to domesticate him, it has strayed away from its core mission of love. And when we stray away from that core mission of loving God and loving each other means all of us, when we stray from that as the church, then cruelty becomes possible, meanness becomes possible, hypocrisy becomes possible in the name of religious faith. But when we find ourselves centered on that way of love, which is the key to what Jesus of Nazareth was talking about, then we find the capacity to navigate ways of life that are life-giving and not stifling.
I do want to ask you one more thing about the royal wedding before we move on. It's something that was kind of spoofed a little bit in pop culture, particularly on Saturday Night Live, particularly how very Afrocentric the wedding was. Kenan Thompson played you on Weekend Update speaking to co-anchor Michael Che.
Oh, it was tough, man, real tough. I preached and I testified and I yelled while 500 stuffy English people looked at me like I was a fart in an elevator.
Yeah, I feel for you, man. What did it feel like up there?
Oh, man, it felt kind of like somebody opened up a chicken and waffles kiosk in the middle of a Pottery Barn.
Kenan Thompson is Bishop Curry and Michael Che anchoring Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live back in May. What did you think of how, first of all, what did you think of the depiction by Kenan Thompson? And I also am wondering what you thought of just how very diverse the wedding was.
Well, I thought his depiction was priceless. It was hilarious. I mean, how could you not think it's hilarious? It was priceless. And the thing is, they did it in a couple of hours. I mean, and they actually got the vestments right.
Oh, wow. So they turned it around and nailed it.
Yeah, they really did. But it was, you know, it was the nice thing about the wedding was it really was diverse. It was a diversity that actually reflects the wonderful tapestry of humanity. I mean, it actually did. I mean, you had kind of a classic boys and men's choir. You had a gospel choir. Somebody asked me, where did the gospel choir come from in America? I said, no, they came from London. They were right there in London all along. You had a weaving of the 1662 prayer book, a Book of Common Prayer of the Church of England with the contemporary Common Worship prayer book. You had those woven together. These two people, the thing about this, I really do think their love actually started to create a new reality, even just for a few moments, where different worlds came together and brought the most beautiful and the best together, and something beautiful happened for everybody. That is about as cool as it gets.
We mentioned earlier this document called Reclaiming Jesus. Tell us a little bit more about that. Reclaiming Jesus from what or from who?
Well, it's really reclaiming Jesus for us in our contemporary world. My friend Jim Wallace of Sojourners and I invited a number of religious leaders to come together early in the year out of concern for the cultural, religious, political, economic, social environment in which we find ourselves. And to be more precise, a concern that very often the most vocal or loudest voices representing Christianity were only focusing on very few narrow issues, and we're not talking about things that happen to poor people. We're not talking about matters of just human decency and justice and kindness. were overlooking real issues that Jesus of Nazareth talked about all the time. And many of us felt, and I personally feel, that we have to reclaim Jesus of Nazareth as the center of the Christian faith. And the Jesus of Nazareth, I mean, look, when you look at Jesus in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, this is what you find. You find somebody who Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the poor and the poor in spirit. Blessed are the merciful, the compassionate. Blessed are those who are persecuted because they try to do right. Jesus teaches, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Jesus says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's the Jesus of Nazareth. That's Jesus. You know, you can go on. Matthew 25, as you did it to the least of these who are members of my family, you have done it unto me. When you care for poor people, you're doing it to me. And when you don't care about the poor, you're doing it to me. That's Jesus talking. That's the Jesus of Nazareth, one who says in Matthew 22, for example, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength. And he says, this is the first and great commandment, and the second is just like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And he's quoting Deuteronomy and Leviticus. He's quoting Moses. And he says, on these two, the love of God and the love of your neighbor, mm-hmm. hangs all the law and the prophets. Do you know how extraordinary that is? That is basically saying that everything that Jesus is about, everything that God is about, must be consistent with love of God and love of neighbor. And Episcopalians have heard me going around the church saying, if it's not about love, it's not about God. Or as Duke Ellington used to say, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Right, right. And that's the verse that our Mormon friend was referring to when he referred to the second commandment. But I mm-hmm. wonder if the issue really, as you've described it, is that the church needs to reclaim Jesus. Mm-hmm. Or, well, I get the sense that people, whether they are churched or unchurched, know Jesus in some way. They know the image of Jesus as someone who was loving and caring and who said, let he among you who has no sin cast the first stone, and mm-hmm. who cast the money lenders out of the church, and who healed mm-hmm. the sick and raised the dead, and this really nice guy fed 5,000 people. Mm-hmm. And they know that something about that image of Jesus doesn't match the church, particularly uh-huh. in its most political mm-hmm. you know, moments. Is this, I wonder how much of this just has to do with changing or shaking up public perception, or acknowledging that some people view many people of faith, many institutions of faith, as inherently hypocritical to what Jesus actually was.
Well, and that's the key. Reclaim Jesus and be less hypocritical. My goal, our goal, is to help the church to be more consistent with Jesus of Nazareth and less inconsistent. I go back to that old Dostoevsky. I don't know why I'm quoting Dostoevsky all this morning, but that's part of what he was getting at. The further the church strays away from Jesus, it's going wrong. A church that does not care about the poor is inconsistent with Jesus. A church that does not care about injustice in the world done to anybody is inconsistent with Jesus and is going wrong. A church that does not care as much about how people have to live here on earth as it cares about helping them find their way to heaven is going wrong. I want to go to heaven one day, but I'm here on earth right now. We got to make sure, well, the Lord's Prayer says, thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And so a church that does not follow the way of Jesus of Nazareth is not being Christian.
Mm-hmm. Let me get to a few more of your comments from two Richards. One Richard tweeted, I returned to Christianity, to an Episcopal church, because of its changed position on gay people. Then there was the comment we read earlier where Richard wrote, the churches that are the most popular are the ones that tell people they don't need to worry about all those pesky liberal teachings of Jesus. You can't be a Christian and be apolitical. I'd love to get your thoughts going as we continue our conversation about the intersection between faith and our politics, or faith mm-hmm. and activism. A few days after you delivered that sermon at the royal wedding, you led a procession and a vigil in Washington. Here is a part of the sermon at the worship service before the vigil.
Oh, love your neighbor. That's why we're here. Love your neighbor. Love the neighbor you like and the neighbor you don't like. Love the neighbor you agree with and the neighbor you don't agree with. Love your Democrat neighbor, your Republican neighbor, your black neighbor, your white neighbor, your Anglo neighbor, your Latino, your LGBTQ neighbor. Love your neighbor. That's
That's the bishop speaking at a worship service in Washington in May. Now, you have said that that vigil, that procession, was not a march, not a political statement. I wonder how you see this idea that the second Richard I read raised of the impossibility of being a Christian and being apolitical.
Mm-hmm. Well, anything that is authentically spiritual, genuinely spiritual, following the way of Jesus of Nazareth, is going to have implications for our lives individually, our lives socially, our lives politically and economically. But it is not intrinsically in and of itself, first of all, a political, economic or social statement. And let me give an example of what I mean. Dr. King, just to use him as an example, was very clear that he was living values that come from his understanding of the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. It was the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth and the values that come from that that led him to march, that led him to protest, that led him to public action. But it wasn't public action for the sake of public action. It wasn't a liberal social agenda or a conservative social agenda. It was following the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth and putting them into practice and actually living them out. You see what I'm saying? So that I would suggest that for Christian folk or people of faith, it's always important for us to identify what are the core values that our faith teaches us. In other words, what does Jesus of Nazareth teach us, and how do those values get translated into public action, public policy, and how we actually live our lives? That's the unique contribution, if you will, of religious faith in the political sphere, values that get lived out. And let me give you a good example, just a personal example. It's easy for me to go in the voting booth and vote for what I want. You with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
It's slightly different for me to go in the voting booth and vote for the values that I hold to be true, whether I want that or not. The truth is, the biblical notion of love is not really sentimental. It's actually deeply spiritual. And it's really about a way of living that is unselfish, that is actually selfless, that actually seeks the good and the welfare and the well-being of others, even sometimes beyond my own unenlightened self-interest.
Well, and that's something that's come up in a number of comments from our listeners who are wrestling with faith, with values of any kind, mm-hmm. and the way that politics play out. Here is a voicemail that one of our listeners in California, in the Central Valley, left in our inbox.
My name is Rebecca, and I'm calling from Fresno, California. I grew up in an evangelical Christian family and have since struggled with that a lot as I've aged. And now I'm a 42, middle-aged white mom. And I find that as I try to find Jesus in the world today, it's really important to me that we look at how we treat humanity. And being anti-abortion isn't enough for me anymore. We need to be pro-life and plenty of other avenues. All those babies are my babies. All those moms running from horrific conditions belong to us too. And if we can't treat them with kindness, we don't deserve to be called Christians.
Rebecca, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us. And we also want to acknowledge that we got hundreds of texts from members of the Wanting Text Club. Lots of you are really, really wrestling with this. So whether we read your comment on the air or not, just know we heard you and we felt how fervently many of you are trying to figure out, for lack of a better term, what it means to vote Christian. So thank you for engaging us in that struggle as you're working through it. Bishop Curry, what would you say to folks like Rebecca?
You know, God bless her. What a dear soul. And she's trying to find the right way. One of the things I'm coming to realize the older I get, and I'm only 65, and I guess in American society, that's a teenager. But but at 65, I've started to realize that the bottom line in everything that I do, when I have to make decisions, whether they are deep moral decisions or even pragmatic, practical ones, I need to ask myself the question, does this look like love of God or neighbor? And I have spoken to my friends who are in politics, And I said, you know, you need to ask yourself the question when you're engaged in policy debates and discussion, does this look like what it means to love your neighbor? Does this look like what it means to love God in life? And I think that's a discerning question that can help us navigate, does this look loving? Sometimes you don't know what the right or wrong thing is to do. I mean, we must make medical decisions where these are judgment calls, and you must find and do the most loving, unselfish thing that you can think of.
I wonder if there's a divide in some faith communities between seeming loving and or being loving and seeming nice. Like, I would think about a faith community, for example, that is very anti-abortion. And it may not be nice to say to a woman, sorry, this is not something we should allow you to do with your body. But they may interpret it as the most loving thing for the sake of the mother and for the child and for the family as God ordained it. How do you work through that?
By being loving. And I'll give you an example from the Reclaiming Jesus. Clergy and lay leaders who came together with Jim Wallis and when we met together to help to craft that Reclaiming Jesus document, there were Democrats, Independents, and Republicans. There were Roman Catholic, Protestant, and evangelicals. There were people who would be characterized as pro-life and pro-choice. We all agreed on that document, Reclaiming Jesus. And one of the tenets of that notion of Reclaiming Jesus was the principle that love must guide and direct us in everything, no matter what. That if it's not loving and if we're not doing it in ways that are loving, that is inconsistent with the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. So you may be known as someone who is pro-life or pro-choice and as a Christian, but do that as a loving person in a loving way, genuinely seeking what is the most loving thing that you can do or be about.
Could you clarify what you mean by loving? How do you define being loving? Is there a biblical definition that you look to?
Yeah. I think the paradigm for what being loving is for Christians is Jesus of Nazareth going to the cross. His giving up his life was an act of selfless, sacrificial love. It was not had nothing to do with appeasing an angry deity. That's wrong. That is just bad theology. It wasn't about that. Jesus was basically saying, look, I've got to show you what love looks like. And in John's gospel, he says, greater love has no one than this, but that they give up their life for their friends. That love is sacrificial. Love is actually selfless. Love actually seeks the common good, seeks the greatest good that is possible. In other words, this is not sentimentality we're talking about. Mm-hmm. This is seeking the good, the common good, even when sometimes I want to do something else.
Liam writes, though not an Episcopalian myself, I would like to ask Bishop Curry why he specifically thinks the world needs moderate religious voices in these times of incredible social and economic upheaval. It cannot be trite to ask what Jesus would do. Wasn't the carpenter from Galilee a radical in his own time? Good question, Liam. We'll put that to Bishop Curry as we continue our conversation. We'll also go to a little bit more music. Bishop Curry's been DJing today's show. You heard Mahalia Jackson going into the first break. This is the Preservation Hall Jazz Band's version of His Eye is on the Sparrow. We'll get to more of your questions and stories in just a moment. Stay close.
His eye up on the sparrow.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One. The CreditWise app from Capital One recently released three new features, including a social security number tracker, to help users quickly detect fraud for free. Here's head of CreditWise, Joe Whitchurch.
While identity fraud is intimidating and can sound really complex, a little bit of effort can go a long way in helping you understand if you've been a victim of identity fraud.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
The midterms are finally here. There's a lot of anticipation for the results, and the NPR Politics podcast will be in your feed Wednesday morning to break down what happened. But if you can't wait that long, you can head to our feed now for what to watch for on election night.
Before we get back to Bishop Curry, a quick heads up about tomorrow. It is Election Day today, and tomorrow we'll focus on the midterms, what happened, who won, how much remains unresolved, and what it all means for the nation. We'd love to hear from you anytime about today's votes or tonight's outcomes, especially if you're voting for the very first time in these midterms. Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Or you can send us a radio-quality audio file through our app, 1A Vox Pop. We will nurse our post-midterm hangovers together, and we'll share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to Bishop Michael Curry, the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. His new book is called The Power of Love. Plenty more we'd like to get to, but let's start back with Liam's question. Liam writes, I'd like to ask Bishop Curry why he specifically thinks the world needs moderate religious voices, and moderate is in quotes, moderate religious voices, in these times of incredible social and economic upheaval. It cannot be trite to ask what Jesus would do. Wasn't the carpenter from Galilee a radical in his own time? Bishop?
Great question. You know, the truth is what I'm really talking about is sometimes the loudest religious voices that may get the most airtime, if you will, may not always be representative of what Jesus of Nazareth was talking about. And sometimes it is the quiet, steady voices that are plodding along that actually may be pointing in the right direction. That's what I'm really getting at. Of course, Jesus was radical in his own time, but the word radical comes from the Latin word, which means to get down to the root. It doesn't mean to be the loudest. It means to get down to the root, to what really matters, or what old folk used to say when I was a kid, where the nitty meets the gritty.
Mm-hmm.
To get down there. That's what it is to be truly and authentically radical. And our reclaiming Jesus is a way of being genuinely radical, not in terms of being loud, not in terms of being militant, but in terms of getting down to the root of Christianity. And the root of Christianity is in Jesus of Nazareth, who said love of God and love of neighbor is the key to it all. One of our dioceses, Episcopal Diocese of Ohio, has a slogan that says love God, love your neighbor, and change the world.
Well, see, I kind of wonder, though, in terms of Liam's point, I hear what you're saying 100%. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, I mean, Jesus in his time was not just a radical. He was considered a heretic. He called himself mm-hmm. the Messiah, which was kind of what got him in the trouble that got him crucified. And there are some congregations and some denominations who I've not heard an Episcopal church say this. I've heard some of the larger Presbyterian churches, the more conservative ones, preach a message that says, you know, our radical form of faith may seem radical to an unchurched world, but Scripture's on our side. We have a message that the world needs to hear. Even if it doesn't necessarily like to hear it, we can purvey it in a way that is friendly and that is welcoming, but that's also resolute in saying, I'm not saying this to make you feel bad. I'm saying this because it's in the Scripture, whether you like it or not.
You know, let me give you an example of one of the radical teachings of Jesus. And you know it. It's where Jesus was in the 10th chapter of Luke's gospel. Jesus is talking to a lawyer. The lawyer pushes him. He says, what's the greatest law in the law of Moses? And Jesus says, well, what does Moses say? And the lawyer says, well, love God and love your neighbor. And Jesus says, do that and you'll live. And then the lawyer kind of presses him. He says, well, can we define neighbor more precisely and maybe a little bit more narrowly? That's when Jesus tells the parable of the Good Samaritan. Now, people know that parable, or at least know of it. We have Good Samaritan laws, Good Samaritan hospitals. What is often missed is in that parable, Jesus took two people who were basically, if not outright enemies, people who represented ethnic groups who were at animus with each other. And the parable says that love of neighbor happens when one takes care of the other's needs, regardless of that person's ethnic or religious background.
I'm sorry, Bishop Kim, I just want to make sure we're all clear on exactly what the story of the Good Samaritan is. It's about this man who made a journey from Jerusalem to Jericho.
That's
along
right.
a dangerous road. He gets mm-hmm. attacked by robbers. He's injured by the wayside. This one guy comes up, a priest, a religious leader, leaves him there. Another guy comes up, another high-ranking religious leader, mm-hmm. leaves him there. The third guy who comes up is a Samaritan. The Samaritans are this kind of shunned, ostracized group, and the Samaritan picks the guy up, dresses his wounds, takes him into town, pays for him to get cared for, and leaves enough money behind so that the guy can fully recover. Did I get that right?
You got that right. And Jesus says that's what it looks like to be a neighbor, and that is who is your neighbor. Now, apply that parable of the Good Samaritan to our contemporary world and our contemporary lives. What does that parable say about our debates and discussions about immigration? What does that parable say about how we should treat and respond to those who are refugees? What does that parable say about the quality of our public debate in our political society? You see what I'm getting at? Jesus is very clear that people who very often are at animus with each other need to find ways to live together as brothers and sisters. The truth is, we must learn to debate but not inspire hate. We must learn to discuss and deliberate and disagree without being disagreeable. And we must learn to engage public policy issues, but never forgetting that public policy is always about people, and people come first. That's the love of neighbor that Jesus of Nazareth. Now, that's truly radical, but it's not radical in terms of being loud. It's radical in terms of showing us a way to live together as brothers and sisters. Dr. King said long ago, we will either learn to live together as brothers and sisters, or we will perish together as fools.
Rhonda emailed, I am a Pittsburgher looking for ways to reconcile the massacre of Jews at the Tree of Life Synagogue. I was raised to live in love, to act in love. So how would you differentiate being angry with our present political and social distress and actual hate? I often feel ashamed that I hate our president. I hate what he is doing to our country, and yet I want to walk in love. I defended the right to peacefully protest his visit last Tuesday. Am I a hypocrite, Bishop?
No, you know one thing, one of the things that Jesus says that may be helpful, he says in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, love your enemies, pray for those who despitefully use you. The notion of praying for one's enemies at first, or people you have animus with, at first that sounds like, you know, why should I pray for them? I think praying for them is as much praying for the person who is praying as it is for the person who is the enemy. And so one of the things I've tried to do, and it's not easy to do, I hear what our sister is saying, it's not easy, is to pray for those people that I disagree with. Or sometimes it takes a while before you can do it. But to work up to the point where you can pray for that person and ask God to love them and help them and to lead them in the right way, and then say, God, and while you're at it, help me do the same thing. Something happens over time when you pray for somebody, because it's kind of hard to pray for somebody and just outright hate them.
It's kind of like you're asking people to give themselves permission to stop hating someone long enough to pray for them?
Yeah. And to understand and to be gentle with yourself that it's human to have emotions and feelings like anger and, you know, even hatred and all that. That's human. But to say, okay, there's a passage in the New Testament that it's in Ephesians that says, be angry, but don't let the sun set on your anger. In other words, what that's saying is, okay, you're human. You're going to have these emotions. Have them and then say, okay, Lord, I need you to help me to become the me that I say I want to see in somebody else. And that changes me as much as anybody else. You know, but Booker T. Washington used to say, don't let anybody drag you so low as to make you hate them.
MJK tweeted, I walked into today, meaning the midterm elections, I walked into today as if readying for battle. Your show with Michael Curry is softening my heart. Compassion feels like the stronger force. Nicholas tweeted, in regards to faith and politics, my biggest concerns are with those that have hijacked a message of we are the party of God, but then turn around and cut funding for health care, social safety nets for the poor, and education while increasing funding for the gears of war. Amanda tweeted, I live in the Deep South where devotion to religion and the teachings of Christ are essential to life for most people. But those same people support the hateful rhetoric of the Trump administration. How do you think Christians justify that juxtaposition? Bishop, I would just amend Amanda's point, if I may ask, whether you think that they necessarily view it as a juxtaposition. Maybe for a lot of Christians in the South, it's perfectly congruent, and that might be where the disconnect is.
Well, I still live in the South, so, and I'm a Christian in the South, I don't believe that hate or hateful speech or meanness or cruelty is even remotely consistent with any Christian values or the teachings. That's why I go back to Jesus, or the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. You know, I really do believe that kindness and goodness, you know something? Let me back up a little bit. Kindness is not weakness. Goodness is not complicity with what is evil. Goodness is a way to overcome evil. As St. Paul says, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. We do not create more light by creating more darkness. The truth is, the way to banish the darkness is with light. And so we will create, you want to reduce crime in society? Let's improve our schools. You want to improve society so that it's safe for everybody? Make sure that children, from the time they come into this world, have opportunities for full education and training to grow up into a productive citizens. I mean, if you want to, secure country,
right,
where we are defended, then let's make sure that every child has an adequate education so that our military actually has people who are capable of doing the job in a highly technological age.
Right. I hear you on that, but I see Amanda's point too. She sees this disconnect, particularly between what we described in 2016 as the evangelical vote, and how strongly it went for Donald Trump, and how even in the 2 years since his election, his rhetoric has just gotten kind of more poisonous and more divisive. But we haven't heard evangelicals in any kind of a full-throated way saying, hey, tone it down, cut it out. I hear where Amanda's coming from.
Yeah. Well, she makes a good point. And I would argue that I don't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican, whether you're liberal or conservative or something in between, we must learn to have public debate that does not inspire hate.
I'm interested in – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bishop.
No, I'm going to say it is as important – we can disagree over the specific content of policies that people stand for, but there should be no disagreement that anybody who inspires meanness directed toward anyone, that is just flat out wrong. That is not the American way, and we can do better than that.
We heard from Ray Suarez, journalist, author, speaker. Many of you remember him from his days on public radio. Ray Suarez tweeted, enjoying listening to my presiding bishop. Just heard him preach this week in New York. American trends say we may have a tough century ahead. The Episcopal Church will still be standing and witnessing in the year 2100. In what shape is up to us? I wonder, Bishop, how you see declining membership, not just in the Episcopal Church, but in a number of denominations, as younger people are increasingly likely to describe themselves as agnostic or atheist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that's real. That is real. But what I really do believe, and this is the key, I think the more we help folk get in touch with what this Jesus of Nazareth is actually teaching, what he actually said, not what the culture says about him, but what he actually said, let me tell you something. That Jesus is interesting. That Jesus is worth paying attention to. You know the movie Talladega Nights?
Mm-hmm.
Remember the movie? Remember the...
To make a Talladega Nights reference, Bishop Michael Curry?
Yes, I am.
So we went from, okay, for those of you playing the home game, we went from Dostoevsky through the Song of Solomon, through, I think, Matthew and Mark and John. We haven't hit Luke yet.
Yeah.
And now we're getting to the legend of Ricky Bobby. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Make it work. Go ahead.
There's this great scene where they're getting ready to have dinner, and they have the Kentucky Fried Chicken bucket on the table, and they're getting ready to have dinner. And remember, Ricky Bobby gets ready to say grace, and he gets off, and he starts talking about, I love the Christmas Jesus. I love the baby Jesus. And the old man in the scene said, but didn't that baby grow up? The truth is, everybody loves the baby Jesus. But that baby who grew up, he actually has something to say to 21st century America, has something to say to millennials, boomers, Xers, and whatever, Generation Z. This Jesus of Nazareth is of interest. And I would argue that when my Episcopal Church begins to focus on this Jesus and help folk literally listen to what this dude is telling us, this brother's got something to say to us that matters. And then we won't be worried about how many people we have in church, because the impact of folk who are trying to live their lives on the love of this Jesus of Nazareth is going to be so great that it will be just wondrous to behold.
Before I let you go, I want to play a quick clip from an interview we did with the Reverend Adam Hamilton. He leads the nation's largest Methodist church, and he also emphasized the power of religion to bring people together.
You know, I feel like the church has a role to play in bringing healing to a polarized nation. I mean, we're a place that's, our defining value is love. So if we can't figure out how to do this together in our congregation, what hope is there for the world?
Before I let you go, Bishop Curry, I just kind of wonder how your faith walk is going. This has got to be challenging to be in the middle of all of this upheaval. Before we let you go, how's it going with you and ministers like you?
Well, you know, these are not easy times in which to live. But I really do believe that, like that old hymn says, if you cannot preach like Peter and you cannot pray like Paul, just tell the love of Jesus, how he died to save us all. And then the song switches and says, there is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. That balm in Gilead is the way of love that Jesus teaches. And when I get tired and I get dispirited, I go back to that balm in Gilead.
Bishop Michael Curry is the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. His new book is called The Power of Love, Sermons, Reflections, and Wisdom to Uplift and Inspire. Bishop Curry, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Today's program was produced by Paige Osborne. To learn more about her and the rest of our staff, visit theoneA.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and please vote. This is 1A.